haunted bridges and dormitories, spooky cemeteries, and small town ghosts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll explore the ghost lore of Iowa. College campuses provide rich fodder for ghost stories, and we'll start today with Vernon Trollinger, the author of Haunted Iowa City. If you go looking for ghosts, it's good to have some direction. I'll talk with Chad Lewis, one of the co-authors of the Iowa Road Guide to Haunted Locations, and Barb Heiser has been studying the paranormal for 25 years. She shares her experiences in Small Town Ghosts, a ghost hunter's casebook of paranormal theories and investigations. We want to hear your ghost stories too, the ones you've heard and the ones you tell. Join our conversation after the news. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. A couple of years ago, Redbox, the video rental kiosk company, released some rental records that showed that Iowa is among the most scaredy-cat states in the nation. Three Iowa towns, Ottumwa, Ames, and Des Moines, made the list for where the fewest scary movies are rented. So, we may not like scary movies in our state, but we do have our fair share of ghost stories. And in the next hour, we're going to explore the ghost lore of Iowa. I'll talk with Chad Lewis. He's one of the co-authors of the Iowa Road Guide to Haunted Locations. Barb Heiser will be here. She's been studying the paranormal for 25 years in both Illinois and Iowa. She shares her experiences in Small Town Ghosts, a ghost hunter's casebook of paranormal theories and investigations. We also want to hear your ghost stories this hour. What ghost stories did you grow up hearing? What ghost stories do you tell? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're going to start the hour with Vernon Trollinger. He's just written a book called Haunted Iowa City. Vernon, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you very much.
And it seems to me that college campuses provide a lot of rich fodder. Maybe not just the campus, but college towns provide a lot of rich fodder for ghost stories. Why do you think that is?
You know, as in a town like Iowa City, the students come through and the population changes over almost monthly in some instances, I think. And people have experiences, they pass them on. They're not in town long enough for them to really explore them. So just bits of the stories get through, they change, they get embellished. And poof, you've got a ghost story. That's probably the best way, the easiest way to explain it.
Well, they also seem to make for good pickup lines.
Oh, yeah. from the Courier Hall story, yeah.
Right, right. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. But you tell some wonderful stories about, not just about ghost stories in Iowa City, but you dig into the history of what may actually be behind these ghost stories being told. And let's start with a wonderful example of that, and that's your story that you call The Wandering Cadaver. And this is the tale of Mrs. Mary Herrick. What happened to her?
Mary Herrick was an old woman who died in 1870, around Christmas. Her daughter lived in Iowa City. Her husband was a retired doctor who had turned, who had become a horticulturist. The family was friends with the Irish family, who Captain John Irish was one of the founding fathers of Iowa City. His son was the editor of the Iowa City Democrat, and he was also the one of the trustees of the University of Iowa Medical College, which
had just
opened up in September. When Mary died, he was one of the pallbearers at her funeral at the house, and they took her up to Oakland Cemetery and buried her there. And it was a cold, I mean, it was winter in Iowa. The last thing you want to do is dig a grave, but they chiseled out the dirt and buried her. A few days later, the sextons noticed that the dirt had been loosened up and the body had been taken. Word spread around very quickly that it was very likely that the body had been taken to Old South Hall, which was on the Pentecrest at that time. It would burn down later on.
Right. So the theory was that some medical students had dug up the body and were dissecting.
Added to it that was that the they had found a notebook that belonged to the assistant or of the chief anatomist for the university at the time. So a mob assembled, wanting to get in. They wanted to burn the place down. They were waiting for a search warrant to be served by the sheriff, who waited because by the time he got it, it was New Year's Eve, and he dawdled and futzed around and waited until the next day to actually execute the search warrant. So during the night, townspeople from Iowa City circled the Pentecrest to make sure that nobody got in. What they couldn't see was that some of the medical students had gotten the body out and had made their way down through the mists towards the Iowa River. John Irish, that was the name I was trying to remember. He was at his office at a place where they now called the Cauldron Hotel, Opera House, rather. And they showed up in the middle of the late at night and saying, "You've got to help us." And he said, "Why?" And then realized that they had the body. So he told them to take the body about 4 miles west of here and hide it, stash it in a hay mound. And he got in touch with the family, the Herrick family, which included Dr. Kimball and Mary Herrick's son, Charles, who was a civil engineer living here in town, and said, "If I can get the body back, will you just let the matter drop?" And they agreed. So he said he would have it brought to the back of a funeral home at the other end of the block. And that would put it around College and Dubuque Street. So the appointed hour came. They put a coffin up behind the undertaker's place in the alley. They waited. The body was delivered. They went out back to look at it, and they discovered that Mary Herrick's face had been partially dissected. All bets were immediately off.
That whole amnesty agreement,
the whole
was
thing
out
just,
the
just,
window,
yeah, it
right?
was out the window. They screamed and hollered. The family screamed and hollered that, you know, they wrote letters saying that the university hospital, you know, the college should be burned down. I'm sure there were people, you know, yelling for people to be tarred and feathered. The thing is, the uproar wasn't limited just to Iowa City. It spread throughout the entire state. There were newspapers throughout the whole state calling for this hospital to be shut down. The college to be shut down.
Right, the medical school.
The people that would probably really, really delight to hear this was the new medical college down in Keokuk, Iowa, who many of the people who were down there were rather upset because many of them had not been invited to join the faculty at the college. Anyway, the John Irish, the assistant, and two of the students were arrested. No grand jury would bring them to trial. Eventually, they were released, and that was the end of that.
Although the Herrick family did not recover quite so quickly. No. They were still very
Charles
upset.
Herrick, who was Mary's son, took it very, very hard, and by May, he died. According to the notice that were published in the paper at the time, he was to be buried alongside her. And the president of the university was there at his funeral, and it was a very illustrious affair. Well, I went looking for them over at Oakland Cemetery, and I could find absolutely no trace of them. The grave is missing. A lot of stones are toppled over or worn away. I talked to the sextons. We looked in their computer files. Many of them had been transcribed from handwritten records.
No trace. Did you go out at night? Did you run into Mary Herrick wandering the The cemetery?
No. Well, no, I went out late afternoon, but mainly so I could see. A lot of those stones are limestone stones. They're faded, especially by acid rain and things like that, and they were just really hard to read. These are stones that had been around there for maybe 150 years.
But there was a rich history of grave robbing in Iowa City in the early days of the medical college.
And it continued even after the medical college was established and the law had been changed that by the state that university would get the bodies of unclaimed prisoners from state penitentiaries. In fact, I ran across an article out of Chicago where a body had been intercepted in a barrel at a railroad station, marked to be shipped to to a specific doctor at the University of Iowa Medical College. And this was in the 1880s. Just strange.
Yeah. So what is Mary Herrick rumored to be doing? Is she wandering the cemetery? Is she wandering along the river? Where could we find her?
I don't know if we'd find her anywhere. It's just that her corpse went missing. They brought it back. It was supposed to be buried in the cemetery, and 140 something years later, it's gone again. And so is her son.
Well, we're going to in a couple of minutes. We're going to talk about the famous and infamous Black Angel of Iowa City, also found in Oakland Cemetery. But quickly, before we get to the break, let's talk very briefly about a ghost named George, who you say in your book, or people say, roams the Hall Mall on the pedestrian mall, right off of the pedestrian mall in Iowa City.
Yeah, George is supposedly a ghost that is in the Hall Mall. That would be the second story of the Schneider building. The Schneider brothers moved in there at the turn of the century, last century rather, and were cabinet makers. And as was common to that time, they made coffins as well. Well, they got into the funeral business and they were preparing bodies there. Sometime they moved next door into a building called, which is now known as Vito's, which is a bar.
It closed.
Yeah. But there's a report in the newspaper today saying that a young architect intern had a paranormal experience there and believes the place was haunted. There have been stories circulating around that, but I think most of them have been started since the 1970s when the Hall Mall started and people started hearing bumps and thumps in the middle of the night when they were working there late.
And one of the people who was working late and doing an inventory claimed to have seen the ghost.
She saw a ghost on a rainy day. She looked out and or saw a man walk past the store, and he was completely dry. She thought that was odd, stuck her head out into the hallway, and supposedly watched him disappear into thin air as he walked down the hallway.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about haunted Iowa City. We're also going to be joined in a moment by Chad Lewis. He is the one of the co-authors of the Iowa Road Guide to Haunted Locations. Vernon Trollinger is the author of Haunted Iowa City, and we'd love to hear from you as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They're all together ooky, the Addams Family. Their house is a museum.
I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. Today, we're talking about the ghost lore of Iowa, and with me in the studio right now is Vernon Trollinger. He's the author of Haunted Iowa City. We also want to hear your stories, the ghost stories you've been told, the ghost stories you like to tell. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this conversation would not be complete without a conversation about the Black Angel. And the Black Angel's in Oakland Cemetery.
It's an Oakland Cemetery.
In Iowa City.
It was brought to town in 1912 and spent the winter in storage and then erected in 1913.
And there are so many stories about this Black Angel. And you tell a lot of the false stories, a lot of the myths about it. And some of some of the threads that go through those that are just so fascinating to me. Like, so many of the stories claim that the Black Angel was originally carved out of white granite and that she turned black overnight because of someone's...
Or white marble.
Okay, white marble.
The purest, whitest marble possible.
Right, like
that. And
right.
It had to come from Italy. it was in depending on which version of the story. And these are the ones I wrote about in the book are just kind of like mashups of all the possible variations I could put together.
But let's talk about some of the modern mythology about this Black Angel, because I'm sure these are things that pretty much every student that goes to the University of Iowa hears about. So if you go to Oakland Cemetery and encounter this Black Angel, what is supposed to happen to you?
Well, if you go and touch it or kiss it at all, that whole thing has been around since the 20s, really. Supposedly you're going to die. You know, you're going to either die a horrible death within a week or 7 years, or whichever version you prefer. There have been people that have been married at it, beer bashes going on around it. I did a photo shoot for the Press Citizen and for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Both times I went over there, there were more things clustered around its feet: pennies, notes, jewelry. There was a wristwatch. People go there and they leave things. It's almost like they're expecting it to be alive. It's very strange, the presence of the statue. It's black. It's in the cemetery. That's what makes it weird.
Right. And people tell stories about, let's say, a romantic couple having contact near the angel and one of them dies. I mean, these are the stories that get passed around.
Right. Yeah. Again, a lot of them seem to be romantic holdovers from when the statue was originally put up. Mildred Augustine, who was the author of the first couple of Nancy Drew stories, and I have to thank Tim Parrott for doing his marvelous history on it. He quoted lots of sources from the Iowa City Press Citizen, which I was able to find online and basically tell the same stories. She wrote a news story in a magazine article which contained about 50 to 60% inaccuracies, which really only added up, added to the stories. But a lot of the stories involve one of the lovers or a wife or a husband who has been unfaithful at some point. Either the woman was unfaithful while the husband was away, and is on the particular date when he was away selecting the angel that he was going to bring back to her. It was hit by lightning at sea and turns black. Another one is where the woman is dying and makes her husband swear that he's going to be faithful to her even after she's dead, and that she will know because of the color of the angel. Well, the moment he casts his attention to another woman, it turns black. Then there's the other one, another story about that it was put up by a witch who is trying to atone for the death of a child. It just goes on and on and on.
And what I love about all of these stories is that, as you mentioned, that, you know, it's carved out of white stone and then turns black, although the angel is clearly not carved out of stone.
It's not carved out of stone. It's and it's really interesting because it was it's cast bronze. It's about 9.5 feet tall. It was done by an artist in Chicago who happened to be Bohemian, as was the woman who commissioned it, Maria Felderit, or Teresa Felderit. He cast it out of bronze. Now, normally you'd expect it to be turn a nice bronzy brown, a nice warm, like you think of a suntan. But where it was put up in the cemetery probably caught the prevailing winds of people's coal-fired furnaces during the winter. And very shortly during the winter it was put up, it turned black. you can still see the glint of some of the bronze where it's been scraped and scratched over the years. It still shows through, but for the most part, it's black.
And you mentioned Teresa Feldwirt, and that's the other thing that I think is mm-hmm. funny about all of these stories is that, you know, the name Feldwirt is clearly on the monument,
right.
and many of the stories seem to have nothing to do with the Feldwirt family, but she put up this statue for her son.
She put it up for her son and also for her husband. When her husband died, she was an interesting woman. She left her native Czech village of Strimlov, and the circumstances are not very clear. She was married at the time, or she may have been married. We don't know if her husband had died or had divorced her or what. But in the dead of night, she leaves her village with her son, Eddie, and makes her way to Bremen, Germany, travels across the Atlantic, comes to America, makes her way out to Iowa City, and settles among her countrymen out here. She was trained as a midwife, and she opens a business here in Iowa City. And now at the time, the state regulations for call yourself a doctor were very loose. And so some people called her a doctor, some people did not. It was very up in the air. But she did open a Russian steam bath at 716 Bloomington Street. The fun thing is that when me and my wife moved in together, we moved in at 710, which is the house next door to
nice.
It, which at the time I didn't know. Anyway, her son, Eddie, grew up. He was 18 years old. He was working in a local pharmacy downtown. One day he took sick. Turns out it was meningitis, and he died a few days later. And so they buried him at Oakland Cemetery. He was buried under a large cement slab in an underground crypt. Years later, after her husband died, Teresa decided to build this fantastic monument. She had lost a leg after she'd been bitten by a rattlesnake while working with her husband, bringing in hay at at his ranch in Washington State. So she was really a pathetic looking, pathetic character. Anyway, so she had the monument raised. They reinterred Eddie's remains there. They put her husband's ashes there as well. And at that point, she did not intend to be buried there.
So it's a monument erected by a woman of means, an unusual woman
an
of
unusual
means
woman.
With unusual taste in statuary, I guess. And I want to welcome someone else to the conversation now. Chad Lewis is on the line. He's the co-author, along with Terry Fisk, of the book The Iowa Road Guide to Haunted Locations. Hello, Chad.
Happy Halloween to you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And in the beginning of your book, you talk about how it's nice if you're going to go looking for ghost stories, and you and Terry Fisk did. You said you wished that you had a guide. So this is what you've done. You've written a guide for all of us who would like to go out and find ghosts.
Yeah, we found that so many of these places, the directions were terrible, the stories were embellished or made up. So we really wanted a guide that would tell people how to get to these places and what to expect and some of the legends and myths surrounding them. So that's what we did. It's really meant to be an adventure guide to the scary places of the state.
Well, and in the beginning of the book, your co-author, Terry, writes about an experience that he had with the paranormal, and that's something that got him interested in these kinds of stories. How about you? How did you get hooked on ghost stories?
Well, I really blame it on my home state of Wisconsin, and I blame it because I grew up not too far from a UFO capital of the world that we have in our state. And when I studied psychology, I was more interested in why people believe in the strange and unusual. Or why do they not? And I started 17 years ago presenting my findings, and people in the audience would come up and just ask for help, that they thought their home was haunted or they saw something in the woods they couldn't explain. So it really just kind of spiraled from there.
So why, in your research, why do people believe in this kind of stuff? And a lot of people do.
Yeah, the overwhelming simple response is because they've had something happen to them. If you see a ghost or a mysterious creature, you're much more likely to believe in it than someone who hasn't. But I also found that people who knew someone who had an experience were more likely to believe in it as well. We found that people that the higher the education level, the more likely they believed in the possibility of these things being real as well. Women believed in a lot of these things more than their male counterparts, and on and on and on.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories that, you and Terry tracked down in Iowa. You went all around the state, and you broke up the book by parts of the state. But we just had a Twitter from somebody who clearly grew up in the Burlington area. This is from Julia, and she mentions two of the stories that you write about and explored in your book. And one of them is the ghost hitchhiker on Highway 34. Tell us about that.
Yeah, these phantom hitchhikers appear all over the United States. Most of them are female, and the one in Burlington was thought to be a former slave running through the area that still haunts the place. And many people will be driving down the road when all of a sudden they see what appears to be a woman on the side of the road, thinking maybe she broke down or she's in need of assistance. They'll slow down to ask her what's going on, only to find several things stick out about her, one being that she doesn't look like you and I look today. She looks like she's from the 1800s, early 1900s. Others say that she's nearly transparent. You can see right through her, and she's dressed as though in, you know, Victorian garb or old 1800s garb. I even had someone who claimed that they picked up a gentleman on the road on 34. They were about to ask him where he was going, and they looked over and he was gone. But they were so convinced they had picked up a real person that they scoured the area looking to see where this person may have disappeared to, and left the area convinced that they picked up this vanishing hitchhiker.
Well, she also mentions another story from that area, and this is a story that has a lot of similarities to a lot of other stories that you hear about places called Lover's Leap. But this one is Lucinda, the tragic lover of Stony Hollow.
Yeah, and you're right. There are so many of these Lover's Leaps around the United States, and this ill-fated love affairs that turn tragic. And this is no different, that a woman is thought to be married to a man, but he deserts her. So she takes her life jumping off of a cliff. And now people, not only have they gone out to this secluded area of Stony Hollow Road to see her, and many believe they have seen her jump off the cliffs, but others have heard her cries of help. And again, they think that somebody's out there in need of assistance, but when they go to find where these phantom sounds are originating from, they're left facing nothing but darkness.
Well, there are a lot of stories that you tell in the book that have recurring theme. So we've got a lot of haunted bridges, we've got a lot of haunted bluffs and things like that. But I was also very surprised at some of the more modern locations. For example, you tell a story about a ghost of the Cedar Rapids Public Library. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, this is a fun one, because a lot of times you think of cemeteries and other places being haunted. You don't normally think of libraries as being a haunted place where people will, you know, choose to haunt after their death. But this was a case where some of the library workers reported that there was a woman that of some age that went there, and she was very well known. She would visit the library every day. And one day they noticed she came in. She was normally dressed very modestly, and she came in dressed up a lot more than she normally would have. So the staff took note of this. And then later in the day, other staff members came in and said, "Did you hear the tragic news that Helen had passed away?" And they said, "That's impossible. We saw her here this morning." And they went and described her exactly the way that she was buried, in her best dress. And they thought they were seeing her ghost come in one last time just to grab one last visit to the library. And the librarians said that after she passed, weird things would happen. Books would fly off the shelves on their own, and people would run into this woman they believed was Helen coming back from the grave.
Although when you went and visited the library, you found that no one really wanted to talk to you about it?
That's exactly true. And that happens quite a bit as well, that a lot of the places we went to, not only did some people want to talk about it and others did not, but we found that a lot of staff had stories, more stories than you could ever imagine, while other staff members who had been there equal amounts of times had no stories. They didn't even know the legend. So it seems as though, depending on who you talk to, you get different versions as well.
So when you were traveling through Iowa, you and Terry, did you have any experiences that you would describe as paranormal?
Yeah, we had a lot of things that I always say were unexplained. Just little things, though. We've captured balls of light on our film and our voices on our audio. But one of the things that struck me is I was outside of Fort Dodge in a small town called Tara, T-A-R-A. Locals call it Terror because so many strange things take place at this bridge out there. We have newspaper reports from the 1800s of ghost hunters going out to this bridge because horses refused to go over at night because they saw strange apparitions and mysterious lights and fogs. So when I was out there, I was talking to residents who reported not only of the hauntedness of the area, but they also saw what they believed to be a werewolf-type creature roaming the countryside. And when I got there, I was just bringing out some equipment, and off in the woods, I heard some type of growl that didn't quite sound animal, but it wasn't quite human as well. So, I grabbed all my recording equipment, and it didn't make another sound the entire investigation.
So it's of always, course not.
Yeah, how convenient. So it always is little things like that where it's strange, but was it paranormal? I don't know.
Oh, Chad, thank you so much. That's a great story. Chad Lewis is one of the co-authors of the Iowa Road Guide to Haunted Locations. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, and keep an eye out.
All right, we will, and happy Halloween to you. Vernon Trollinger is still with us. He's the author of Haunted Iowa City, and coming up in just a moment, I'll be talking to Barb Heiser, the author of Small Town Ghosts. This is Talk of Iowa. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're talking about ghost lore of Iowa. With me is Vernon Trollinger. He's the author of Haunted Iowa City, and we're going to bring Barb Heiser into the conversation now. She is the author of Small Town Ghosts, a ghost hunter's casebook of paranormal theories and investigation. She spent the last 25 years doing paranormal investigations in Iowa and Illinois and elsewhere. Hello, Barb.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I'm very glad to be here. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
And that's most of these ghost stories do seem to happen about now. But Barb, tell us a little bit about your personal experience, because you got into paranormal investigation because you had an experience with the paranormal. And can you tell us what you experienced?
Well, it really goes back to 1977 when I was a graduate student in the psychology department at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. There were a number of us in the department who had an interest in the paranormal, so we decided that we would go out and investigate some places that had a local reputation for being haunted. And of those places, we found one that had paranormal activity going on that we actually experienced. And so that was pretty much all it took to hook me on this for life as a hobby. And so I've been investigating the paranormal ever since.
Well, and you tell people that quite a lot, but you said that until very recently you hadn't actually shared the story of what you experienced. And I know it's going to be part of a forthcoming book, but can you tell us a little bit about what you did experience when you went to Rhoda's house?
Well, this, again, goes back to 1977. There was an instructor out at McKendree College that one of the other students knew, and she was investigating the paranormal. So we kind of hooked up with her, and she took us out to an abandoned farmhouse outside of Lebanon, Illinois. And we really did conduct our first full formal investigation there. And from the very beginning, we had all kinds of paranormal activity that occurred. Now, you have to keep in mind that in 77, paranormal investigating was a very different thing than it is now. We had very little in the way of scientific theories or equipment to go by. So the things that we did were different then. You tended to rely on your emotional responses to a given place. And but we also did know about electronic voice phenomenon at that time. That was one of the earlier discoveries, that voices could show up on audio recordings that you didn't hear at the time that you were making the recording. So anyway, what we found in this particular house is that we would have equipment that would work outside the house, but not inside the house. Or it would work in a hallway, but not in a particularly active haunted room. And we even got the very first EVP I ever heard out at the family cemetery that was very near the house, where we heard the sound of a woman screaming, "Help me." In addition to that, there was a location in the house where the house had no electricity. You know, the house had been badly vandalized, and anything that had any value of it had been stripped out years ago. So there was no electricity. And there was an occasion when I got an electrical shock sitting in front of the house and could never figure out how that happened. As it worked, as the investigation continued, we did find out that the woman who was supposed to be the primary haunter of the house was Rhoda Galbraith. She and her husband had built the house in the 1800s and were the first owners, first people who lived there. They had a daughter by the name of Sarah who died supposedly in an accident, falling down a flight of stairs. And we never did quite buy that idea that it was an accident. And there was a lot of information around town that it hadn't been an accident, that Rhoda had actually gotten very angry with Sarah, hit her, and that Sarah fell down the stairs. So we had Rhoda, who seemed to be a very malevolent kind of a ghost. She would act out by, there was an occasion when some students from the college who had been using the house for beer busts, took some things back to one of the women's dorms that they had found out at the college. And they had poltergeist activity in that dorm until such time as they brought the stuff back. That was something that the instructor had gotten involved with investigating because of the sudden poltergeist activity in the dormitory. This all got rather complicated. We did a lot of very foolish things in those days, like using a Ouija board and, you know, going back time and time again. Ultimately, we decided that we needed to stop going back. The way that it was working out was the psychic on our team was becoming obsessed with the house. She believed that if she went out to the house by herself, she could confront Rhoda and end the haunting. Well, that sounded like a pretty naive and a very bad idea to all the rest of us. So we decided that we would stop investigating.
And in your career as a paranormal investigator, you say that you don't take money for doing paranormal investigations.
Oh, no, no. That's an important aspect of doing this kind of work. As soon as you start taking money or charging people for this, they can accuse you of engaging in fraud. You know, of course you told those people that they had a ghost because then you could charge $250 for every time you went back. You know, so we are absolutely clean when it comes to this. We will not even accept expense money. We cover the costs of our investigations ourselves. We do it because we're fascinated by it.
And your goal when you do a paranormal investigation is to not just discover what is going on, but you say your goal is to help whatever is haunting a location move on.
Exactly. It's one of the things that differentiates my team from a lot of the teams that are out there is that we do what we call crossover work. And it is our goal to, whenever possible, establish rapport with the ghost and with the family and help build up some trust so that in time we can ultimately, you know, communicating through the psychic on our team, we can help that ghost to make a different choice and decide to cross over to the other side rather than staying in the house or the land or wherever it is that it's haunting.
Can you tell me about a paranormal experience that you've investigated in Iowa?
Oh, sure. There's a house in LeClaire that there's a whole chapter on it in my book called, the chapter's called Little Bug. And this is the ghost of a little girl that was haunting a house in LeClaire. The house had been built in the 70s. It was in a suburban-type neighborhood. And all of the families, well, not all the families, but there were still families there, you know, at the time that I was investigating who were original owners of their houses. And so when we found out about this particular haunting, when the family requested that we came, that we come in, of course, we wanted to find out who the little girl was. They had seen her on a number of occasions. She had shown herself to their daughter. Ashley, at the time that we did the investigation, was 21, but she was 12 years old when they moved into the house. And she had seen her like four or five different times. The activity that the little girl tried to engage in was attention-getting behavior. She would make loud noises. There was one time when Debbie, the mother, said that it sounded like someone downstairs had picked up the washing machine and dropped it on the concrete floor. She also had a tendency to throw things. One time Ashley went into her bedroom and had a candle holder lobbed at her head. So this was a very active kind of haunting and a very busy little girl. The family was in a bad situation. The women would see her and had to deal with her, where the men, she didn't show up for them. So the women weren't being believed that this was actually going on. Ultimately, what we ended up doing was realizing that this was a kid that we were dealing with. And a kid wants attention. And if they can't get attention for being good, they're going to get it by being bad. So she was misbehaving because the family was ignoring her. So what we did was we put her on a behavioral program. Just like a living kid, if you're not going to get attention for being good, then you'll be bad. So we started the family working on rewarding her for being good. She had a calendar, and every day that she didn't do anything that scared anybody and she didn't destroy anything, she got a star and she got praised. And when she had a month of this, we came out and we brought her toys, you know, because she liked to play with things that were in Ashley's room. So ultimately what ended up happening was we threw her a birthday party. We promised her that the next time we came back, we would have a birthday party for her. And so we did. We brought cupcakes, we had ice cream, we sang her happy birthday and opened her presents. I had really hoped that she would blow out the candle herself, but like most kids, she didn't cooperate. And what ended up happening was our psychic reported that her grandparents showed up for the party, who, of course, had passed on many years before, and that ultimately the little girl made the choice to go with her grandparents and cross over to the other side. After that, the paranormal activity in the house stopped.
I'm talking with Barb Heiser. She's the author of Small Town Ghosts, a Ghost Hunter's Casebook of Paranormal Theories and Investigations. And she was just telling us about a paranormal experience that she and her team investigated in LeClaire, Iowa. And we have just a few minutes left. We asked at the beginning of the hour that you send us your ghost stories, the ones that you've heard and the ones that you've told over the years. And we did get an email. Vernon Trollinger is also still with us. He wrote Haunted Iowa City. And this is an email about a ghost in Iowa City. Is there a ghost on the top floor of Courier Hall? I heard reference to this ghost in 1978 in my freshman year.
Well, it's an interesting story. I think that the ghost story may have come about shortly after Courier Hall was originally a women's dorm. And I think the story may have come about because the worst possible thing that could happen to a women's dorm happened. Men moved in. I think somebody used it to talk about a trunk room in the upper floor as saying, you know, this room is haunted. And maybe that it caught on. But the story is that up on the top floor, the attic floor, which is the fifth floor, has these rooms that were emptied and unnumbered, and they were originally used for trunks. But the story came about that either three women had committed suicide there or had done so serially because they were involved with a man who betrayed them.
Right. And the idea was that this used to be a dorm room, but then it was turned into a storage room because of these horrible events.
Because of the horrible events and blood coming out of the walls and things like that.
And again, this is a theory that your theory is that it was used as a pickup line by the men who moved into the dormitory.
after the war. But as it turns out, if you look at the plans, they were never used for anything other than storing trunks. And in fact, the room was unnumbered until 1947, when the whole dormitory had brand new numbers put in to identify everything like that. But part of the story goes that it was originally a dorm room, but because of the deaths and the blood and all this stuff, the university moved in. They stripped out the walls. They bricked up the old walls and took the numbers off the room so it could never be used as a dorm room again.
Well, and speaking of college campuses and the ghost stories that they provide, Rob sent us an email from Des Moines. He said, I went to Morningside College in Sioux City. Back in the 1990s, one student hung herself in her room in the largest dorm on campus. The hall she lived in is called the Hidden Hall, since there's no easy way out. There are many stories of students hearing gurgling coming from her room and seeing phantoms wandering around Dimmitt Hall. The original school building at Morningside had a grand piano in the upper level. When it was converted from a one-building school to a two-building school, the piano was walled off. People can still hear the piano being played from the attic at night. And he also, in his email, mentions yet another story from Morningside College. So this does seem to be something that they abound on college campuses.
To wall off a piano or to
They're
wall
hard
off,
to move. They are
to,
hard
to wall
move.
Off a, in the case of Courier, they said they bricked off a plaster wall. You know, to haul bricks up quietly and secretly.
Right. So we're nearly out of time. But Barb Heiser, of course, a lot of people love to talk about ghost stories on Halloween. In your experience as a paranormal investigator, is this a more active time of year for the paranormal?
It does seem to be. And I'm not sure if it's because of the legendary idea that the veil is a little bit thinner between this side and the next this time of the year, or if people are just paying more attention. And so they're noticing things going on this time of the year that they may ignore during other times.
Well, certainly. Barb, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Barb Heiser is the author of Small Town Ghosts, A Ghost Hunter's Casebook of Paranormal Theories and Investigations. We also talked today to Vernon and Trollinger. Thank you, Vernon, for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
Vernon Trollinger is the author of Haunted Iowa City. And earlier in the hour, I talked with Chad Lewis, who's one of the co-authors of the Iowa Road Guide to Haunted Locations. So if you ever wanted to go out looking for ghosts in Iowa, that's certainly a roadmap for you. Happy Halloween. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime. Our address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Werewolf, bar mitzvah, spooky, scary. Boys becoming men, men becoming wolf. Werewolf, bar mitzvah, spooky, scary. Boys becoming
becoming men, men becoming wolves.
All right, that was great, Trey. Okay, it's over. That's a wrap.
Oh. The next day, what happened? The Toma didn't teach.
Oh,
I got up in front of everyone to give my little speech. Then my teeth turned into fangs and my nails into claws. And